Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, here with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, we turn today to foreign policy, specifically the growing tensions between the U.S. and Iran. And over the past couple of months, we've had attacks on oil tankers in the Straits of Hormuz, blamed on the Iranians. We've had reciprocal shootdowns of American and Iranian drones, increased U.S. military presence in the region, Iran saying that it's more aggressively enriching uranium, escalating U.S. sanctions. Most recently, we've had the Iranians capture a British oil tanker. So nothing but tensions as far as the eye can see. And before we get to the ins and outs of what's happening now, I just want to rewind the tape a little bit. So last year in May, the Trump administration pulled out of the nuclear agreement that had been struck with Iran during the Obama administration, and it shortly thereafter laid out a series of demands that it would need to have met to make a new agreement with Iran workable. And to hear a lot of the president's critics tell it, that was the root cause of all the hostility that we're facing now. And if President Trump, they argue, had just left well enough alone, we wouldn't be dealing with any of this volatility. So why don't we start by having you remind us what that original deal looked like and giving us your sense of whether the Trump administration was right to exit it.
Yeah, well, the original deal suggested that in 10 years, Iran would not enrich uranium and develop to a level that they could develop nuclear weapons. And it had inspections of most, but not all, of its facilities, and they had to notify the Iranians. So, and it did not cover miniaturization of weapons or ballistic missiles, much less supplying terrorist funds to surrogates like Hezbollah in Syria and Lebanon. So Trump comes in and says, you know what, this is the worst deal of the century. I don't know if it's the worst deal of the century, but nobody argued with him about those points. And he said that when you lifted sanctions, as Obama did in 2015 and 16, then you sent billions of dollars into Iranians' coffers, and we're seeing the effect of it in Lebanon and Syria, and then with terrorist cells all over Europe. So when we're getting rid of this, and by that we have all the cards on our hand now, because we're the largest oil and gas producers. So if they shut down the Straits of Hormuz, we can still get oil from Canada to augment our own resources, or Mexico. And if the price goes up, it doesn't really hurt the largest oil producer and gas producer in the world. And if Europe is challenged in getting a lot of its supplies from the Middle East through the Straits of Hormuz, or China is, we kind of shrug and say, well, you guys, you don't meet your NATO commitments, and you don't seem to want to keep the sanctions on, so we can't really help you. We'd like to. And then if China gets angry, that's half of Iran's oil goes to China. We're in a trade war with China. So it's hard to envision how Iran is going to pressure us, and I think that's the key. So Trump is now needling them as they get poorer and poorer every day from this embargo, sanctions, whatever we want to call it. And they're getting more desperate and desperate. And because Trump, before an election, is not going to invade, and he's not going to hit back unless they kill a lot of people. And if they kill a lot of Americans, then it's going to be a very popular thing to do, is to retaliate tit for tat, but disproportionately tit for tat. So I think he's in a pretty good situation, and time is running out on Iran. Time's not on Iran's side.
So the president came in for a fair bit of criticism from both the left and some precincts on the right for this decision that he made last month to call off a retaliatory strike on Iran after they had shot down the American drone, which the argument from the American side was this was over international waters, it had every right to be there. At the time, he justified the decision to pull back by arguing that it wouldn't have been proportional because it would have brought somewhere, by his estimates, in the range of about 150 deaths. How should we think about that decision, both on the merits and in terms of how the president did it, with this what seemed like a very public push towards a strike and then a very public pulling back?
Well, a lot of it depends on what happens next, because they're going to do something again. But politically, it was pretty smart. Democrats never win when they attack a conservative president from the right and say, damn it, why didn't you bomb those people? That's not going to work with Democrats, especially when the Democrats have to hear from Trump that he wanted to save lives by not gratuitously retaliating for a drone that did not cost an American life. But more importantly, he's telling his Republican supporters, and I think the world at large, see, I'm a man of patience. I'm not ready to preempt. I don't believe in optional wars. This is exactly the type of restraint that I campaigned on in the swing states. However, now that I've shown that I'm magnanimous, don't take that magnanimity for weakness, because the next time you do it, you're probably going to get a disproportionate response. And when that occurs, I think the left can't say, well, he's trigger happy. He always just tries to find an excuse to do something because he didn't do it last time when they urged him to do it, or at least criticized him post facto. And then the Republicans are going to say, well, the country's behind you. It wasn't like you shot from the hip. So I think that's what he was trying to set up. And he plays this very strange game. He's with Bolton and to a lesser degree with Pompeo, that they're the bad cops. And now he's a good cop. So he shakes his head and says, Bolton wants to go to war, but I'm the man of peace. It's a much more effective shtick than with McMaster and Mattis as the good cops who say that they're the adults in the room and Trump is the bad boy who wants to go launch missiles. Trump didn't like that role. So when he sort of shuffled out his cabinet, and now he ends up with two hawks, it allows him to be the peacemaker, which I think that's in a role that he enjoys a lot better in this bad cop, good cop routine.
One of the factors that you always have to consider in foreign policy is the character of hostile regimes. That is to say, how do they understand the world? And as a result, how does their understanding of what's rational diverge from ours? So with Iran, for instance, this was a paramount concern back in the days of Ahmadinejad, where there was a pervasive fear that this guy had sort of a mystical apocalyptic worldview that could have real implications for how he saw his country's role in the world. The current regime doesn't quite look like that, but they ain't Canada either. So how should we think about whether and to what extent Iran is a rational actor in foreign affairs?
I mean, every actor, even North Korea, has an element of rationality because they don't want to commit suicide for all the talk about apocalypse. But Iran is probably the most anti-American of all these regimes because their vision is for a Shia Persian hegemony all throughout the Middle East, restoring, you know, the glories of the 14th or 15th century. And the United States is the chief, along with Israel, is the chief impediment to that. And now that the Arab regimes have sided with Israel and the United States, it makes it even more difficult. And now they're out of the Iran deal, it makes them especially more difficult. And now that Obama is gone, they feel they've lost an enabler who sort of was sympathetic to the underdog Shia, the underdog Persian, the underdog Iran. And that's all over with now. So they're very frustrated. And yet they can't find a practical, useful way of getting back at the United States because, as I said, they've got a president who is not like the preemptory presidents Clinton or Bush of the past. And then, moreover, he talks all across the political spectrum. And then the United States next year will be the largest exporter of oil and gas. So it's almost like one OPEC country getting mad at another OPEC country. And people forget that. And again, time is on our side. It's up to Iran to feel what they have to do. But they're slowly starving to death, and they're slowly going broke. And it's a big change of fortune, and it's a great disappointment after dealing with John Kerry and Barack Obama and getting billions of dollars in infusions. So a lot of their angst and anger is just the radical shift in fortune from the two administrations that have made them so angry. And that's why John Kerry's met, I think, four times stealthily in Loganak fashion with the Iranian foreign minister. Well, I think what we would see is what we saw under Obama under steroids. So Mr. Nasrallah lately boasted that he had 1,500. Remember, he's the Hezbollah cleric that runs the show in Lebanon and Syria. He brags that he, not Iran, has 1,500 missiles that he acquired during the last 8 years. And that acquisition was enabled by lifting the sanctions in the last 2 years before the Trump administration. So I think we would assume that Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran would really beef up their ability to, and that's what we're talking about, a missile ability to hit Israel or to hit assets in Iraq that are pro-Western or even all over the Middle East, maybe even Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. If the sanctions are lifted, and then if they're lifted and the deal's back in place, then you know what's going to happen. They're going to think, you know, these Americans might elect another Republican who might cancel Iran deal 2.0, so we're going to say that we're not going to enrich in 10 years. Then they're going to go full speed with free trade and profits and get that ability as fast as they can and lie about it. And they're counting on two things. One, an appeasing Democratic administration to take advantage of. And two, that Americans will get fed up with that and help elect somebody that'll be deterrence to their ambitions. And they want to avoid that by taking advantage when they can. So it would be a disaster if a Democratic administration came into power and tried to reinitiate the Iran deal.
So the final question that I'll put to you, the president has been explicit about the fact that he's not looking for regime change in Iran. That's not a universally held position on the right. And even amongst those who wouldn't make it an explicit aim of American policy, there are still plenty who wouldn't mind if it happened to occur. Americans, of course, seem to have become much more sensitive, particularly in the wake of Afghanistan and Iraq, to the difficulties that attend to trying to reorder foreign societies. There has long been an argument, however, Victor, that Iran could be different, that there's enough of a residue both in that country and in the diaspora community, many of which might come back under the right circumstances, that you could have a relatively liberal, relatively democratic Iran with significantly less difficulty, which is not to say ease, than you did in some of the other places we've been involved in recent years. What's your view on that?
Well, I think what you're referring to is something like the so-called Green Revolution that met Obama when he came into office in the spring and summer of 2009. That is a grassroots, fully autonomous indigenous movement to democratize or liberalize Iran. And Obama wanted no part of it, remember. He thought they were sort of neocon sympathizers or something, but all he had to do was voice moral support given his unique position, and he might have been able to encourage more people to rise up. But he wanted to be the progressive fixer who alone would know how to deal with the theocrats with whom he was somewhat sympathetic in their anti-American, anti-capitalist, anti-Western rhetoric. But that's still there, that anger. And as long as Trump avoids a major war with Iran, which will rally support to the theocracy and just allows them to stew in their own juice, that public frustration and dissidence is going to increase, and then he can encourage it from afar without getting in a war. But the whole thing that will encourage that is the increase of Iran's economic challenges brought on by sanctions, and then the avoidance of a major war that will make poor, starving Iranians want to fight Americans and rally to their government and Tehran's efforts. So that's what we want to avoid. And again, I think the cards are all in our hand. We have time on our side. They don't.
All right. You've been listening to The Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read Victor's work at defining ideas@hoover.org, as well as at victorhanson.com. And if you enjoy The Classicist, please rate the show on iTunes. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.